Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's new daily show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on the facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During the show, we give you access to local officials and experts on COVID-19 and community actions related to it. If you have questions for our guests, please email them to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181. You can find a list of upcoming guests on our Facebook page or on our website, kmxt.org. Audio from each day's program will be posted on the website. To the sad, sad truth, the dirty
lowdown. Monday edition of The Lowdown. We'll begin with announcements first. As of March 20th, no confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Kodiak. This is the emergency service update number 2. The council declared a public health emergency on Tuesday, effective Wednesday. The Emergency Operations Center has been activated to implement precautions for the possible spread of the virus in our community and to request resources to support the community's need. In an effort to streamline communication with the public, the Kodiak EOC has developed its own Facebook page. Please follow Kodiak Emergency Operations Center on Facebook for current community updates and information. The airport still remains open until the state owner of the facility announces a closure. Because there is yet no approved vaccine or medication for the virus, personal hygiene and social distancing are measures that can protect the community. If you're sick, stay home. Call your medical provider and follow their instructions. The Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities received inquiries about closing airports. And again, airports are not closed as of yet. They just tell you to use precautions if you're going to fly or go to the airport. And once you return, to isolate yourself or quarantine yourself. We'll get to that word in a little bit. The Coast Guard base is following precautionary measures and has temporarily closed a number of facilities. These closures include the movie theater, the pizza parlor, Golden Anchor, bowling alley, boathouse, the teen center, and the galley now has takeouts only. The chapel is closed for services, but the chaplain is available if you need them. Local emergency services officials, the CDC and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services urges you to follow these guidelines regarding your health during the public health emergency. If you're sick, stay home, call your medical provider, and then follow their instructions. If you don't have a regular health care provider, you may contact Mill Bay Health at 486-7300 or the Kodiak Community Health Center, 481-5000. Visit the Kodiak Emergency Operations Center Facebook page for updates and more information. And in the studio with us this morning is Elsa DeHart, are you officially the head of the public services in Kodiak?
No, I'm not. I'm actually the reproductive health nurse consultant right now, but I'm a nurse consultant for public health nursing.
Ah. You work in a lot of different capacities.
I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us, public health in Kodiak. Most of us associate public health in Kodiak with taking the kids for shots. Mm-hmm. You provide a lot of different services, though. Well, let's talk a little bit about you before we get into the big picture of what the business does. You're a nurse.
I am. Uh-huh.
And you've been working with public health for a decade now?
Yeah, 12 years.
Mm-hmm. So what leads one into public health?
Well, I think that public health it's a really interesting nursing career. And I think what brings you into it is that your whole community is your client and not just an individual. So, you know, nursing is always very rewarding as we take care of our individual clients. But when you really look at being able to make big differences, making policy changes and working with communities of the whole is really rewarding.
So you did this intentionally?
I did.
Yeah. And how in the fabric of medical services and nursing, how is public health connected to the other services that are available on the island?
So public health, we work a lot with infectious disease and a lot of other different services. So we're here to, we do provide some individual services, but we also support the whole community as in their efforts when they have things to do. So we are the ones who, if a provider thinks that they may have a positive skin test and thinks somebody may have TB or been exposed, then we're the ones who take that over then and do the whole investigation and see if they really are and take care of them in that way. Or if there was a bloodborne, like somebody went out hunting and got Giardia, we're the ones that the state calls to investigate that. We work really closely with our Department of Epidemiology.
So there's no doctors involved with public
nurses.
Health?
Mm-hmm. We're all nurses.
Okay. So the normal services that people in the community would go to public health for would be for the flu shot, for sexually transmitted diseases, for opioid abuse, substance abuse issues, right?
Well, a little bit. So in 2016, we cut back some of our individual services with all the big, huge budget cuts in 2016. So now we can only see people for most things up through like our reproductive health services. We can do, pills and up to Nexplanons, IUDs, everything. But we have to stop at age 29. So 30 and over, we can't really care for unless it's like TB or another kind of infectious disease. Otherwise,
for just those particular services or for all services?
So for all of our basic individual services, we go up through age 29.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So, but things like TB falls outside that, or infectious disease, or COVID, or some of these other bigger picture things, then we see people of all ages.
So are you specifically a state-funded organization, or is this in combination with the feds?
No, we are state funded, although our state organization does get some funding from the federal government.
Okay. So how does it work then in terms of, is there brain trust involved in policy? I mean, you're dealing with nursing and policy at the same time, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you've spent half of your time doing policy. Where does the policy get developed in regards to community reaction when something like this happens?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
I'm asking, from the guidelines, I imagine you have like emergency preparedness steps that are already in place that you follow. And does this come from the State Department of Health and Social Services, or is it in conjunction with the World Health Organization or with FEMA or?
Right. So the way we're kind of organized is like, even though I say we're all nurses, we do have Dr. Zink, who everybody's very familiar with, and she's the one who, like, we have medical directives that come down through her. So we can do these treatments and things as nurses without having, physicians' licenses. However, we're also like, so when this came broke, our section organized a task force. And they're the ones who are in that. We have preparedness nurses in each of our three regions in the state. And those nurses have been really instrumental in putting together what the PHNs on the ground or the public health nurses on the ground are going to be doing in this event that we're looking at or any other kind of. So we've done a lot of work in the last 15 years or more especially since 9/11 in preparing, working on being prepared. And I think you've seen a lot of our pods that we've had, where we've given shots to everybody in town to see if we can get something out within 48 hours, that kind of thing. So that's a lot of our preparedness work.
So how has life changed for you and what you've been doing then over the course of the last couple of weeks?
Oh, it's been really crazy.
That was an easy question.
Yeah. No, so we've been doing a lot of work just at our health center level, seeing what supplies we have, what we might need, getting some things here. We have to work with our community and seeing what they need. You know, we've helped working with our providers in town as they've set up this tent, for instance, working, making sure everybody's on the same page. We've gone and talked to our emergency services group to talk about public health and what pieces we could do. So we talk to those people frequently and try and work on it at community level. So and then we're still seeing our folks around that we usually see.
Oh, you are?
Mm-hmm.
You're open for business?
Well, we are. You know, one of the things that they know about this, and they said early on, is that, you know, because the flu has been so bad this year, you know, we've lost over 30,000 people to flu in the United States this year. So flu is still bad, and there's still a peak in the flu. So if we can keep people from getting the flu, that'll help keep some of the pressure off of our medical providers. So we're providing flu vaccine right now to anybody of any age that wants it. And we can even go places and give it to people if we find it. So we're trying to get that word out that we have flu vaccine, and we are open to give that to anybody who needs it, any age.
So it seems like there's been kind of a movement to limit the amount of appointments into regular or operations to reduce contact with people. How safe do you feel continue to do what you do?
We are doing a lot of immunizations. We aren't doing as much, that's true, with our, you know, with some of our, we're not doing our reproductive health clinics right now. You know, we are filling people if they already have a prescription and need their pills, we'll give them their pills, although we can do that by the phone. One thing about public health is we don't see sick people, you know, down at the clinic. We really see healthy people. So that's kind of a good thing. But not too many people have been pretty good about not wanting to come in for things right now.
Well, how staffed are you to meet the demand?
So we have two nurses right now and myself, so two other nurses. One was called back in kind of off of leave, so she's working just part-time, just doing these immunizations and things mostly. So, and then we have our office manager.
But if something happens, if we get a case here, mm-hmm. what gear do you go into and what's your role?
So then we really kick into gear here. So our role is really, if we get a case in Kodiak, it'll be our job to do what we call contact investigation. So that's going to be finding out, we go back 48 hours from the time that person first got sick, and then we try and find out everybody that they have been in contact with, and then let them know, and they need to, watch themselves and monitor their temperatures and things like that. So, and we'd be checking in with them. So that's what happens. And of course, you know, if people quarantine, like, you know, they've been asking people to stay home, that really limits the number of people they may be contacts if somebody does get sick.
So the... You're on the phone. You're trying to make these connections, which is what I assume they make with all the positive tests we've been getting, where they're now coming up with, there doesn't seem to be a connection.
Right. Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
So I think that just means that somebody was that they came in contact with something, or maybe even a surface or something that somebody had touched. They can't link it to a specific person.
Right.
So, you know, maybe been somebody that was asymptomatic or virus they picked up somewhere else.
So you guys are, this is part of what you would, you normally would have done even before COVID, because of the other infectious diseases that have been present over the years, right?
Right. So our nurses do about a year of orientation, and part of that is learning to do contact investigations.
Okay. And that's in Alaska. We got tuberculosis, and we have, you know, a variety of other things that have happened over the years. So does that change the nursing practice then? I guess what I'm wondering is if a case comes, do the nurses then switch over to become like full-time investigators?
Well, in public health, even when we're nursing and we're seeing our clients, we're not doing like bedside nursing, in a hospital or, you know, with sick people. So we are investigators. I mean, that's one of our main roles in public health nursing, which makes it kind of fun.
Yeah.
Being a bit of a detective. Like our bones.
I got some questions we can get from people who have submitted some questions to us, if I can find them. Seems to me we won't be able to tell whether the virus infections are still increasing exponentially or whether efforts to flatten the curve are working until testing is widely available. I think testing should be effective universally to get good numbers. When will we have the ability to test more people? Is our poor testing protocol ongoing so the numbers of infections won't appear to increase rapidly?
Yeah, testing is always a big issue. So the thing about testing is right now there is a limit of tests right now, although they're working hard to increase the supply so that we can do that. And like I mentioned earlier, we are hoping in a couple weeks to be able to do like a drive-through testing thing for the community. But right now, testing is limited to people that are sick and may have been in contact. The thing about testing is it's not going to change the treatment any. We don't have a treatment. So even if people are sick and they take care of themselves and hopefully get over it, we don't know if it's, you know, necessarily a really bad cold or a bronchitis or is it COVID.
Right.
So,
there is some movement in the testing front, though. I mean, that we're going to have more, and there's different types going to be available that may or may not be available here.
Yes. They're looking. I think the FDA has just approved a rapid test, so we may be able to see those in a few weeks. It depends on manufacturing.
But again, then we'll just know numbers.
Right.
We still don't have treatment.
Exactly.
So are you involved in the treatment at all?
No, we don't really. We have great providers here in Kodiak, and they're the ones who would be managing people's treatment.
Okay, so your role is then, is PR now? Is that kind of?
Not really. We're kind of undercover. You know, we work with everybody and try and support them in our things and talk about what's out there. And we try and encourage people to do the things that they need to do to flatten that curve, you know, to try and keep people to quarantine themselves so that maybe we can stop the spread before we really even see it.
So what's the best thing that we can all do?
The best thing you can do is stay home if you can. You know, only go out if you absolutely have to. Most places, I think, have been pretty good about trying to do some telecommuting and working from home. Or if you do go to work, you stay away from people. Cleaning surfaces, washing your hands all the time. You know, as nurses, we wash our hands constantly. If we could get everybody to do that, that would be great. Wash your hands all the time. If you can't wash your hands, there's hand sanitizer, different places that you can use on your hands. Keeping surfaces clean. That's pretty much it. You know, just taking care of yourself, eating well, resting.
I have chappy hands.
Yeah. That's a tough one.
Well, is this airborne?
It's more like droplets. And so that's why we say 6 feet apart. You know, that's like how far a cough might go. So it's little droplets that would come out. So when we talk about surfaces, if people touch their faces a lot or like even their eyes because they have lacrimal ducts, you know, if you touch your eyes and you have it on your hands, it could go down the back of your throat and get you sick. You know, so it's hard to... There's wearing a mask or something isn't going to protect you from breathing
rubbing
it
your
in
eyes.
Necessarily.
Yeah. Well, is a mask worse for you?
Well, some people seem to think it is just because people touch it all the time to adjust it. And so then you're actually touching your face more than you might be if you weren't wearing a mask. So the people that should be wearing the masks are the sick people so that they can't cough and put out
project
those droplets.
Right.
Those are the people that need to wear the masks.
So, but if you're standing 6 feet away from somebody or 4 feet away from somebody and they cough, would a mask give you any protection whatsoever?
Oh, it might, unless they cough on the surface and then you happen to touch the surface and then,
yeah.
So there you go.
No, but if they bomb you in the face.
Well, hopefully you're not standing that close. That would not be a nice thing. You're supposed to use your cough hygiene. That's the other thing.
That's right.
Cough into your arm, you know, your sleeve or in a tissue and dispose of it. Yes.
Yeah.
So we hope people will do that.
Well, with so much information out there, you know, and a lot of it fake, Where do we go for the best information about what's going on? I mean,
so I think that the best information, Kodiak locally, you know, our emergency services, they even have Kodiak Emergency Services Facebook page that they put stuff up on, which is great. For the state, it's like there's a website that's DHSS COVID. If you Google that, you'll find it. And then the other sites are, of course, the CDC. So great, has great information, and they get into particulars for every kind of group situation. People like, what do you do when you come out of quarantine? You know, what do you do? What does isolation mean?
Those kinds of things. Yeah, what does it mean? What is the difference between isolation and quarantine?
So quarantine means you're supposed to stay home. Quarantine is kind of like you haven't been sick yet, but you're going to stay home and hopefully not get sick. So you're watching yourself. You're watching your temperature, maybe. I know some people are doing temps a couple times a day if they've been asked to, like, to quarantine themselves.
You just
but
get
just
off the
if
plane.
You're not sick. If you just got off the plane, you should go home and stay home and try not to go out anywhere. But, you know, you're still in your home and kind of stay away from people, but it's not as strict as isolation. Isolation is really when somebody is sick and they need to, like, stay in their room, you know, have a bathroom or clean it every time they use it. You know, I mean, try not to share stuff with them. Be really cautious. You know, it's like isolation.
So what's isolation. The interaction with people who are not, who haven't been off the island, for instance, or they haven't been exposed that they know about to somebody? How do you interact with that person that's supposed to be isolated?
Well, you don't go visit them. You talk to them on the phone. You can talk to them on the phone. You can talk to them, through the doorway or something. They need to be on their own unless they're really so sick. And if somebody's taking care of them, then they need to be really careful about themselves too.
So the dad comes back from, you know, a trip to Seattle, mm-hmm. and is then supposed to be in the house for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Somebody goes to the airport to pick the dad up.
Mm-hmm.
The kids say, hi, Dad. So does the whole family then?
Well, no, because you don't have an actual case then, you know, so that's kind of like a contact of, you know, whatever. So that dad would go home and then hopefully kind of keep himself from the rest of the family, keep that 6 feet. Maybe he's going to probably stay someplace else in a separate room or whatever. And, you know, limit close contact with his family. You know, the reason we say 14 days is just because it's between 3 and 14 days that the illness starts to show. So we think that if somebody stays home for 14 days, if they were going to get sick, they would do it in that period of time.
But I guess what I'm asking is if you're asymptomatic, though, and you were off somewhere, isn't there a possibility you're transmitting it to the people who didn't go traveling, and then they're free to go out into the community?
Well, it could be, but usually you're not going to transmit it until a little bit before you actually develop symptoms. So we're going to hope that, you know, they're staying away enough from their family. And then if that is the case, if they begin to develop symptoms, we go back that 48 hours before they got sick and we see their family was with them, you know, then, of course, the whole family would have to watch and make sure they don't get sick. But, that's kind of a contact. So it's just like anybody else. Yeah.
Well, I think that's where questions are, and where people are fearful of, that they don't really know the answers to those questions. Mm-hmm. So they want to know what the best practices are. This number that you're supposed to call if you're feeling symptoms is a number that the 211 number is your number, right?
Well, you know, it actually goes into a call center, and we do have a lot of our public health nurses manning those phones, as well as other, like, Alaska Respond volunteers and other nurses that are manning those phones. And they can talk to people about what's going on and their symptoms, et cetera. But if somebody's really feeling sick, they can always call their providers. And the providers have nurses that are working the phones, and they want people to call and not come just straight to clinics.
No. If you don't have a provider.
If you don't have a provider, both Mill Bay Health Center and Kodiak Community Health Centers are both federally qualified health centers, and they said they will talk to and help anybody that needs it, and then they'll worry about other stuff later. But if they're not your regular provider, you can still call them, and they will take care of you.
Thank you.
Do you have enough people available to man these phones? I mean, is the traffic through the roof?
Yeah, We've had questions, but it's not real crazy. You know, people are calling 211, which is great because they have a lot of the most up-to-date information.
How are people trained? So these are public health nurses for a lot of times, and locally, if you call your regular provider, you're going to have somebody there. But I'm assuming we have enough people to do that, to man those phones. If we actually do have a case here, then what should we do? You know, I mean, now I think there's a lot of discussion about who should stay open and what we should do. But if we actually have a confirmed case down, what should we do more than what we're doing now to prevent it from multiplying like it seemed to be doing everywhere else?
Right. So really, people just need to stay home. You know, I mean, try and limit their time out in the public as much as possible, you know, and try and stay 6 feet away from people. If we do get a case, of course, that person would be absolutely isolated, you know, and would be monitored very carefully. You know, if it gets to the place where it's in the hospital has a negative pressure room, they have things set up, they know what they're doing, they're ready for it.
It appears from worldwide numbers and from what happened in Ketchikan, you know, that the medical health community seems to be at pretty high risk in this.
Well, that's true, but you know, we're at high risk for a lot of things we do. We're high risk when we work with tuberculosis clients. We're at high risk when we work with other kinds of clients that are really high risk. And so we have precautions, you know, universal precautions that we always follow to try and minimize, you know, transmission of any kind of infection. We're looking at MRSA even, you know, there's lots of things that are out there. So, you know, our hospital's ready. They know, they have really great infection control, and they know what they're doing if somebody is going to be hospitalized.
I got a question from a listener who wants to know, how do I properly sanitize my home with kids?
Do you ever with kids?
Even without the disease.
I mean, even if you truly, you know, if you really clean well and you're doing your, you know, bleach water and your Lysol or whatever you have around, that's great. But on the other hand, you know, if nobody's going out, they're not going to pick anything up to bring into the house. So kids just are kids.
So you're saying keep the kids in the house?
Well, to a point, they can go out in the backyard, right? But you don't want them going out playing with their friends and doing that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Now, this can't be transmitted to dogs, right?
I don't know. There is some talk about on the CDC site that it could go to pets. They say that if people get really sick and have the thing, just it's best to stay away from your pets. Wash your hands before and after you do things about them and try and be respectful of them.
So you shouldn't let Rover roam the neighborhood either?
Well, I don't think he would bring it home. But
yeah.
But if you were in the house with him, you'd want to be careful. If you were infected or really sick, you know, you wouldn't want to.
So you should properly sanitize your home the way you normally do, but maybe use a little bit more. Mm-hmm. There's the question. What if I take my dogs to the beach? Can the dog interaction spread the disease?
Yeah, I don't think as much. You know, and dogs aren't sneezing on people. You know, it'd be more like maybe they could get it on their coats or something too. But if somebody were sick and coughed on them, I guess. But they're probably okay. There is some guidance on the CDC website I saw out there about dogs.
Well, here's a philosophical question, I think, but maybe it's a practical question. Should I stop ordering things from Amazon?
I just watched a long thing on that this morning.
Oh, you did?
I did on the news. And they were saying, you know, there was a study done. It came out in JAMA, in the Journal of American Medical Association, research done through the Natural Institute of Health that came out, I don't know, it's probably been about a week now. How long can the virus live on different surfaces? Yeah. So I think like cardboard, it's like 48 hours or something, or 24. I can't even remember, so don't quote me on that, but there is a time. So some people are like leaving their Amazon boxes on their porch for a day. and not pulling them straight into their house or like, and one, you know, some people were wiping down everything they had. I don't know if that is, you know, hopefully people that are sick that are packaging your stuff aren't there working. You know, if they're sick, they're supposed to stay home, and I'm sure they follow those protocol too. It's being transmitted, so it's a few days getting here. So if it could live on the surfaces, I don't know. But it's probably pretty, really pretty low risk that you could catch something from your Amazon package.
Well, we got a package in the other day that had broken open, and and they had it inside of a plastic bag, you know, and it was everybody that was in the building sort of just took a step back. And and I asked the poor post office guy, they said, you know, oh, what are you, you know, he had gloves on and he was, but the volume of traffic that we have now coming in from Amazon is going through the roof. Yeah. And they are very concerned about where the products are coming from and whether or not they're assisting in helping to transport this stuff. So it would be a really good thing to know if, you know, what would you do? I mean, if you got a package in.
I'm not that worried about it, but I have to say, if you really are, then just leave it, sit someplace for 48 hours or wipe it down when you get it with Clorox.
Yeah.
That would kill any surface germs. Hopefully what's ever in it's been in there longer than that because it's been shipped.
So we sort of know where it came from originally, and we now are getting a better understanding of how it's going from person to person, and we're starting to get a better idea on how long maybe it lives on people and surfaces. What do we do with that knowledge? I mean, how do we eventually get rid of this?
It's a virus, and so I think that if we don't allow it to, you know, pass from person to person, it will die. There, you know, it's places that had huge numbers are now, you know, a couple months later seeing almost nothing. You know, it's gone through its cycle.
Is it still there, though? That's, you know, is it still there?
I think that they're thinking that it'll pop up again at some point. It's hard to say. I saw some things out of Hong Kong where they had really super strict quarantine and it had really dropped to almost nothing, and then they kind of relaxed it and it popped back up a little bit. So it'll be, I think it's going to be a little bit of time, you know, but it should, just like H1N1, we will develop a vaccine. We will develop treatment for it, so.
Yeah. Now, when I was looking at what your office does and the variety of things that are involved, it seems that there's also a huge social component to it, where you're dealing, if I'm correct, don't you deal with domestic violence?
Well, we do, but not as much, as we're more of a resource. So if we have somebody who's experiencing domestic violence, you know, we work with our Women's Resource Center closely, you know, and they will take that case off of us. So we're not actually doing like the final things. We're involved in the community effort to look at domestic violence and those kinds of things.
Well, I only ask that because of the social implications of what this virus has a potential to do in the community. You know, there's a lot of people who talk about, they're more concerned about the financial ramifications of the virus. And there's a lot of people talking about the social implications of it, besides the dealing with the virus itself. So what kinds of things are you seeing in the community? What kinds of things are you seeing in the community, and do we need to prepare ourselves for, even if the virus never even comes here, what we've been through for the last couple of weeks seems to have changed the fabric of the community?
I think it has a little bit. I think, you know, when we look at domestic violence and apartment violence, family violence, you know, it's always a worry when everybody's stuck together, right? But Our KWRCC is really prepared. They've done a lot of work around what they will do, how they can help manage people. I know that they're looking at what to do with some of our homeless folk. Our emergency services people is looking at that, arranging places for those people to be. I think that we also have to think about the isolation, especially when we think about a lot of our elders who are super high risk, so really need to stay home. We need to remember that they're home alone, and you know, and those phone calls and emails and texts, you know, to a lot of those people, it's important, you know, to stay in touch with them. So,
Do you get the impression that people here are taking it seriously? I mean, there's been a number of comments about how some segments of the population aren't really treating this like what it, you know,
could be,
like what it could be. Yeah,
I think that's true. I think that unfortunately there are a lot of people who aren't taking it, but I think Kodiak, well, I'm not out at night, but I think that Kodiak is taking it fairly seriously. And because they took the step of closing like our bars and our restaurants and things like that, we're eliminating that option for people to go and mingle and coordinate, that kind of thing. And there's some community pressure because we are a small, fairly tight community that, you know, if somebody is not necessarily following those guidelines, somebody usually says something to them, or, you know, there's a little community pressure to not have that big party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen it like they have on the news with the parties on the beach in Miami. You know, but I just know that there's probably some resistance to this quarantine or the self-isolation kind of thing that's going on. It's the social implications of, you know, maybe, and actually when I was hearing today from some of the results of people in their 40s and 50s now that weren't initially the target demographic for this thing knocking off, that's got to be pretty troubling. I mean, if this virus is so bad that it can take down a healthy person, right? Mm-hmm. We need to be pretty fearful of it.
Well, and I think that the people that have been getting sick, that, you know, the younger people have better health overall or more resilient, you know, but that doesn't mean they still can't get it. And I just like the flu, although we're not seeing it hitting small children like the flu often does.
What kind of flu do we have? You said it's killed 30,000 people. You know, that's a blip on our radar, and it always has been that. You know, we have the flu. You go in, and if you want or you don't want, you get a flu shot. And we accept the fact that 30,000-50,000 people a year die. Mm-hmm. So, I think there was an original, well, if this is only going to kill 15 or 20, what are we so worried about?
Yeah, unless it's you, right?
Yeah, unless it's you or grandma. Yeah, right. And you're in the demographic. You're going, hey, you know, I'm worried about this. Because we seem to think that because we have a flu shot, that everything's fine.
We have Tamiflu. But, yeah, I mean, it's just to put it in perspective, you know, when you think about how many people the flu has killed. And, I mean, even this virus has only killed a few hundred so far this year in the United States. It's kind of interesting that people don't care as much as they should
about the flu.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess what can we do about it? Because it seems like if you're healthy and you go get your flu shot, they're giving you the best flu shot that they can give you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where at least there's some remedy out there. Mm-hmm. You know, with this virus, we got nothing. You know,
in a year we'll have a vaccine, or sooner than that if they can. They're already testing vaccine right now. So it just, you know, somebody was saying, well, if you give a vaccine to 1,000 people and nobody has a reaction and it works, that's great. But then if you expand it to 10,000 and it kills a few people, then, you know, we need to worry. So they have to take it slowly when they develop a new vaccine to make sure that it's safe.
Right. So what can you do? I mean, what can you do to other than practice good behavior? I mean, is it too late in the game to start exercising more?
Oh, it's never too late to practice good health. Maybe this will inspire some people to get themselves healthy.
Yeah, well, I've heard, you know, drink water all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, drink as much water as you possibly can. Don't drink coffee.
A little bit of coffee is okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, how could you get through the day? But other than that, you know, other than practicing safe distancing, is for personal behavior, is there anything you can do to sort of prepare yourself? Because I guess my assumption originally was it's the 70 and 80 year olds who are already compromised in some way that are going to be most affected about that, and we need to change our behavior as a community so that we protect those people. Now it appears maybe it's changing a little bit and it's able to get people that aren't in that group. So
it does seem to be making a shift, but it's, I mean, anybody is at risk. And, you know, I mean, underlying health issues certainly put you at a higher risk.
Yeah.
You know, there's just degrees of risk. So everybody is at some risk. You could just get really, really sick, you know, and survive, but just get really sick and run up a huge hospital bill for yourself. So take care of yourself.
What exactly does it do to you, do you know?
It's respiratory. So what it basically does is turn into a really bad pneumonia. It makes it really hard to breathe. That's why they're worried about ventilators, etc. It just makes it really hard to breathe. Yeah, it turns into a pneumonia.
So my early belief in this was that if you were close enough to a ventilator, you were good.
Well, who wants to be on a ventilator? I mean, it's not good. And people die on ventilators all the time because
right.
They just can't, you know, they get sick enough that it just can't breathe for you long enough for your body to heal.
Okay. So the question we have from somebody in the audience is, how many cases of this can we, if it came to reality and we had COVID cases here in Kodiak, how many of them put us over the curve? How many of them can we handle at a time safely?
Well, you know, it's really hard to say just because it depends on the degree of illness that somebody gets. If you're talking about ICU ventilator clients, patients, they would be, you know, we work with our midlife, they would be shipped to Anchorage pretty closely. Our hospital, you know, and most small rural hub hospitals are not set up for long-term ICU care. So that's what we work with. I know ANMC just ordered like 200 ventilators that they're getting in. And even though that's the native hospital, they are also like our highest trauma hospital. And so they will, you know, take other people if they need to. Yeah.
But that's for everybody in the whole state, right?
Well, then Providence has lots of equipment, and so does Regional. I mean, you know, Bartlett out on the base, down in Juneau, and then, you know, of course, we have our hospital, big hospital in Anchorage, the Army Hospital. I can't remember what the name is, on Eielson.
So here, pretty much here, you get sick here, you stay home. And when you're really, really sick, then they make a decision that it's time for you to go to the hospital for a little while. Mm-hmm. And if you're still extremely sick, then they're going to ship you off somewhere.
That's about right, yeah.
So on the ground level, unless it gets to be massive numbers, if it trickles in, we're probably going to be doing okay.
Probably, yeah. There'll be a few people who will really get sick, but we're not going to see just everybody getting super, super sick. That's right.
Right. So the best thing we can do is try and keep the numbers as low as possible.
Right. Take care of yourself. Yeah, that's the idea.
What is the care line? Do you know what the care line is?
Isn't that Providence's number? I think that's Providence's nurse line.
For if you're having... I'm thinking that there's a social services line for you if you're feeling like you need to talk to somebody.
There
right?
are those lines, yeah. And, you know, actually our KWRCC also has a their line that they have, their, you know, they have a 24-hour crisis line, and they'll talk to anybody about anything. It doesn't have to be domestic violence. It doesn't have to be. They'll talk to people who are contemplating suicide or just worried about things, you know, and then they have a list of resources to give them to.
So if this is like really overwhelming for people in the community, you know, there's already a lot of people that seem to be reaching out to other people and saying, you know, I'm feeling kind of sad. You know, I'm not seeing my friends. I'm sitting here in my house by myself. A guest came in the other day and said maybe one of the best things that we can do is make phone calls to people and talk to them. But if you're in your house and you're feeling depressed and you need to talk to somebody, you know, so that's a good place to go, to the regular hotline?
Yeah, you can go to the hotline. You could call PAKI, you know, you can call the hospital counseling center. They will, refer you to somebody. There are a lot of other online resources. There are a lot of places now that are doing behavioral health or like mental health counseling. Like through Skype and through FaceTime and all those kinds of things.
Great.
Yeah.
So in a public health, and I guess policy-wise, when you go to the meetings in Anchorage with the folks that discuss community and statewide issues like this, I mean, how is something like this going to be addressed, you know? Is this generally emergency preparedness? I mean, first there's the onset of whatever the emergency is, and then there's a probably community response for what happens after that.
That's true. I mean, you know, it's emergency preparedness is always, it's a huge issue, and so we work on that all the time. And so, yes, the big meetings up there are, you know, with our partners there, the kinds of policies you develop for something like this is what does the nurse do? What does somebody do there? The kinds of things you see coming out on the website, you know, that says follow these guidelines. This is what it means to be quarantined. This is what it means to be isolated, you know, recommendations for people, those kinds of things.
Oh, okay. So your advice is then if you're really looking for information, go to one of those trusted sources for the most current information, the CDC, the WHO, the Kodiak Community Emergency Services thing. Mm-hmm. There's got to be some I'm missing.
John Hopkins has a super cool website where they actually have like an interactive map of where it is all over the whole world.
Oh,
it's very cool. John Hopkins has really good information. But one of those really reputable things, and even when you go through Facebook and you see something pop up there, make sure whoever put it up there, whoever originated that post is a verifiable, you know, it's not just some crazy out there who makes it look really official.
Yes,
you know,
we've seen some of those.
Yahoo magazine, you know, and it's like everybody, oh my gosh, it's out there. It's like it's not peer reviewed. It's not, you know, good science. So make sure you're looking at things with good science.
I stumbled into the kid from Seattle that built the website that's that current NOVA numbers. It scares me to death to look at that thing, but what's your reaction when you look at those, the John Hopkins site, and it shows you infection and spread and death rate and all that? Is there a reason for optimism in this?
I think so. I mean, when you look at, like, for instance, China, and I know a lot of people say, oh, are they telling us the truth? But I think they are. You know, they have had days now with no cases, you know, so obviously it's kind of ramped itself through and done. And that's what we're hoping we're going to see here. You know, I think it's great to see these places where they had big spikes now having very, very few cases where it's kind of gone through.
So in your world, what would you do? What would you do to tell people in our community how to keep themselves best informed and how to keep themselves safe?
Well, best informed is hard. I mean, you have to be kind of techie these days. You need to be able to get on the computer so you can learn these things. Listen to the radio. I mean, you guys have been doing a great job with these shows every day and broadcasting the stuff from the national news. I think those are really good resources. Our paper's done a good job trying to keep people up to date on what's going on. Those are all good sources of information.
We got a question. What can we do to, as Kodiak citizens, to support our clinics and healthcare facilities? How do we get a flu shot right now? And as you said, and is there enough flu shots available if you need one?
There are. We have a bunch, and we can get more. We stocked up when this first came out. That was one of the first things we did, was ramped up all of our flu vaccine inventory. Anybody can call and make an appointment at the health center to come down and have a flu shot.
So did you, maybe I misheard you earlier when we talked about this, but didn't you say that you could take it to them?
Well, we can, but not individuals. Like, for instance, if there were... like one of the canneries, bunkhouses or something needed to vaccinate its people, we might be able to go to them and do it, right? Or we could go to like Bayview Assisted Living or maybe the senior center, not that the senior center's not meeting right now, but those kinds of places.
I think Pat said something about the cat's bus being available for
taking people here, yeah. Okay. So it works best if people can just give us a call and we can fix them up.
So how about the first part of the question? What can the community do to help you do what you do?
So I think our providers and kind of all the providers in town are working really hard to take care of people. And so the best thing that people can do is really respect that. And if they do feel sick, I mean, they want to know about it and they want to help them out, but they need to call first, not just showing up. And people... need to just kind of, I guess it sounds kind of odd, but follow those rules, follow those requests, and everybody will get taken care of as we can.
Do you need money? Do you need manpower?
Always needs money. No, I'm just kidding. When we get to the place where we have, if we do like a drive-through, just like in the past when we've done our point of dispensing exercises, we'll call in the community to really help with some of those services to make that happen. It's a big deal to try and run something like that, and we'll need a lot of hands on board. So
well, you let us know and we'll let them know, and they'll probably come out in droves.
Oh, that would be super.
Hey, thanks for your time. I really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Tune in tomorrow morning for another edition. Have a safe day.